Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you've missed any of my talk radio breakfast show, don't worry. We've put some of the punchiest bits of this morning's show into a bite-sized podcast, the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. Enjoy.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
We're delighted to welcome the Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, to the show now. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Sorry about that.
That's all right. That's all right. You're a busy man. lots to talk about this morning. Let's talk first of all about what you're announcing this morning in terms of more money from that £1.5 billion culture recovery fund to try and help some of the most iconic cultural venues across the country.
Yeah, it's a really exciting day today. We've now passed £1 billion being given to our great cultural institutions. And just to take a few examples, there's 20 million going to the Royal Shakespeare Company up at Stratford-upon-Avon. There's 20 million going to the Royal Albert Hall and to the National Theatre. This is about preserving some of the very best of our culture that gives us such force in the world. And in the process of doing so, we're actually securing 75,000 jobs and more in the supply chains. And also today, we're announcing the next phase of support, which hopefully will see us through to spring and places to start to reopen to aid them in that process.
Of course, there's a big concern that actually it's a lot of the not iconic, the smaller venues that serve smaller communities that actually are the ones who really are missing out, jobs being lost, people furlough some of them, but lots of people actually, even if their venue is getting help, not getting paid themselves because, of course, they're freelance, they're self-employed, many of the 3 million so-called excluded. What sort of help are they going to get?
Well, first of all, with smaller venues, they were the ones that actually got the money first. So we already allocated £500 million in grants to smaller venues up and down the country, 70% of which was actually outside London. In terms of freelancers, just take an announcement like yesterday. I was at the National Theatre. They're putting on a panto there. That's providing jobs to 70 freelancers. And of course, freelancers, whilst I completely understand how very difficult it's been for them, many of them can still access things such as the self-employed support scheme. Across the economy, 70-odd% of freelancers are able to do so. But the only way we can really resolve this is to get full opening. And that's what we're working towards through next year.
Well, talking of panto, we are very much in oh no he isn't, oh yes he is territory when it comes to Brexit. The Prime Minister yesterday told the Cabinet in an emergency meeting there was a strong possibility of no deal. He calls it an Australia-style deal. It is no deal to everybody else. I understand you've been suggesting this morning that you think that actually we could still be seeing a deal. Why do you think it is still possible?
Well, what the Prime Minister warned us was that if we don't get that deal, then we would revert to WTO style rules, which is what Australia trades with the EU on. I think we're 90% of the way there, but two big blocks still remain. First of all, the EU are demanding control of our territorial fishing waters. We can't accept that. No country in the world accepts that as part of a free trade deal. Secondly, they want to have a position whereby if they impose further regulations, we have to match those or face the consequences of doing so. Again, there's no free trade deal with a major economy in the world that requires that. So that's why we're pushing back on those two things. But I still remain hopeful that in the remaining days and hours, we could reach that deal. because it's so much in the interests of both sides to do so. We both benefit from that that free trade. So I hope at the 11th hour we might still get a breakthrough. And the Prime Minister has certainly not ruled that out. That's why he's continuing to push on it.
When you say we're 90% of the way there, we've been 90% of the way there for, most of the last year and still not there. At the end of the day, though, does the Prime Minister and does the Cabinet agree with Theresa May, the former Prime Minister, who said that no deal is better than a bad deal? If all that is on offer from the EU right now or up till the 31st of December is a bad deal, and you mentioned two of those big blocks on fisheries and the level playing field regulations, that actually no deal is preferable.
Yes, the Cabinet was very clear yesterday, and we discussed this extensively. Whilst we want to get that deal, we should not accept the deal at any price. And those two prices that I outlined are too high a price to pay. So if we can't get movement on that, we will have to accept a situation where we have an Australian-style trading relationship with the European Union. It's not as good in many respects as a Canada-style relationship, but I'm very confident that over the medium and longer term, we'll make a huge success of whatever we do as a country, as we always do.
Oh, I was on Question Time last night, and one of the other guests was Malcolm Turnbull, the former Prime Minister of Australia, who was saying that actually this Australia-style deal ain't what it's cracked up to be, and actually there are lots of problems in terms of tariffs and lots of problems in terms of the red tape and the regulatory work that they have to do to export to the EU. Are you sure this is going to be a problem-free, and especially as the British Retail Consortium have reported today, they believe supermarkets and by extent their extension their customers could be hit with a £3.1 billion annual extra bill on food and drink because of tariffs of more than 5% on 85% of food imported from the EU. I mean, are we prepared for this?
Well, there's a number of points there, Julia, if I could try and address each one of them. In terms of the points made by the former Australian Prime Minister, which, by the way, are not shared by other former Australian Prime Ministers, such as Tony Abbott and others, of course, I accept that it would be preferable to get a Canada-style deal. That's why we're still trying to push for it, even to the last hour. In terms of preparedness, yes, we have put in over £1 billion worth of money to prepare for it. But there are going to be challenges, whichever outcome, because whatever happens, we're leaving the single market and the customs union, which we remained in during the transition period. There will be controls, for example, at the Dover border and so on. So that is baked in, as it were. In terms of food price and costs, yes, but that applies both ways. So, for example, if you take tariffs potentially imposed, say, on British lamb, but equally the Irish export large amounts of beef to the United Kingdom, which would also be subject to tariffs. So again, it's in both sides' interests to try and resolve this, even at the last minute.
Okay, let's also talk, if we can, about what's going to be happening next week. On Wednesday, the government is going to have its first formal review of the new tier restrictions. Lots of talk about London, 9 million people moving from tier 2 into tier 3. Of course, not only a massive impact on people's personal liberty and their ability to socialise outside of their homes, but also the ability of the hospitality industry to keep going. We're told 150,000 jobs could go in hospitality as a result. On what basis would London be moved into Tier 3 when it's quite clear from the actual data that we're looking at, the real-time data, is that only 7 boroughs in London are seeing a specific problem. And in those, we are not seeing over 60s being hospitalised. We're not seeing extra deaths. Why is this even being considered?
Well, we always said when we announced the tiering, we said we review it periodically to check each place is in the right tier. So if areas are progressing well and getting the disease under control, they go into a lower tier. But sadly, if areas are getting out of control, they go into a higher tier. As we approach the 17th, we'll examine all of the evidence. And you pointed to some of the things that we will look at, such as the number of over 60s with infections, number of hospitalizations, the number of infections. I desperately don't want London to go into tier 3 for all the reasons you outline, but we have to be driven by the evidence of what's happening. And if it's appropriate, we would have to do that. But we are, we'll consider the evidence. Mm-hmm. and base our decision on that, as we will for every other part of England.
Well, that's the trouble, isn't it? Because when the evidence has been considered, what we've discovered repeatedly is that the evidence to go into the original tiers, the evidence to go into lockdown, and the evidence for the tiers we're in now has all been, almost without exception, either out-of-date data that hasn't shown the true picture of the direction of travel, or it has been completely false, I mean, utterly wrong, computer modelling, this talk of 4,000 deaths a day from COVID, to be wildly outside, you know, even Brazil's worst day in terms of their, or India's worst day in terms of deaths from COVID. There is a real concern that while we're told we're following the science, we're following a very, very narrow band of science that often actually isn't looking at the real data. We've been speaking to Tim Spector, Professor Tim Spector, a professor in epidemiology at King's College, obviously the lead scientist on that Zoe app. Their data has been incredibly closely shadowing what's actually been officially found to be the case from ONS. And he says there is not a case for London to be moved into Tier 3. And yet we're going to be seeing the mass testing of perfectly healthy secondary school age children across boroughs in London, also Essex and Kent, despite the fact that, you know, there is really very little case for that to happen.
Well, I would disagree with you on the final point. I think there's a strong case for doing mass testing. And the reason for doing that is, and it's worth, I have to remind myself, is one in three people that have COVID show no symptoms at all, but they are still very capable of spreading it. So if we have that mass testing, particularly in schools, we can identify the kids that have COVID and they can self-isolate and stop the spread. And that's how one of the factors that helped us get the numbers under control in Liverpool. And I think it is much, much preferable to have that kind of mass testing rather than have restrictions across the board.
Except in Liverpool, again, we keep being told that the mass testing in Liverpool brought down infection rates. It didn't. Infection rates were already plummeting down 2 weeks before mass testing was brought in. Mass testing, if you actually look at the data when it was brought in, actually saw a plateauing of those cases. I mean, we're constantly told we need to do this or that or this or that because that will make a difference. Whether it's a lockdown, we've seen what's happened with Wales. Whether it's a, you know, firebreak or circuit break, we see what happens. And whether we do mass testing or not, none of these measures seem to actually show a clear evidentiary-based benefit from doing them, other than the basic measures of people socially distancing, washing their hands and taking sensible precautionary measures. None of the evidence is there for closing hospitality, for closing schools or any of these things, and going into lockdowns. And yet we keep doing it. When are we going to actually follow the science, which is actually proven, rather than what someone might think?
Well, I'm afraid I'd have to disagree with you on a couple of those points. So in respect of Liverpool, clearly testing was one factor, but another big factor, as you alluded to, was it going into Tier 3. Tier 3 does involve the closure of hospitality. And by and large, as we were going into the lockdown, numbers were rising, both in terms of people testing positive and the real numbers in terms of, for example, people in hospitals with COVID. As we've come out of the lockdown, we have seen a reduction in numbers. I desperately don't want to do any of these things. I'm acutely aware of the impact on people's livelihoods, their mental health, and everything
with all due
else.
Respect, Mr. Dowden, the numbers are very clear. The numbers in the regions, that most regions in lockdown, before lockdown, they were going down already. That's official ONS and Public Health England data.
Those were the ones that had the tighter Tier 3 restrictions.
They were going down when they were in Tier 2. They were going down when they were in Tier 3, and they were going down before lockdown. This is the trouble. We're often saying that these restrictions, these measures, are the reason why something happens. They can't be if those things were already happening before those measures and restrictions were put in place. They simply can't, unless they own time machines.
Well, it was the case that in respect of Tier 3, it was working to start to get the disease under control in those areas. But in areas in Tier 2, and we saw this in many places, they were starting to see rapid rises. I can assure you and your listeners, the last thing that I wanted to do, or other government ministers wanted to do, was to impose restrictions on businesses that were not necessary. I'm fully aware of all the damage they
online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
Right, let's turn our attention to what perhaps we can only dream of, and that is apparently a deal with the EU on trade come Sunday night. That is the latest final deadline that we've got for Brexit and a deal to be done of the EU and the UK ahead of December the 31st. I mean, we are just only 20 days away from ending that transition period. But what is going to happen? Boris Johnson yesterday called an emergency cabinet meeting. He said there was a strong possibility of no deal and said we need to start preparing for that eventuality. Of course, he calls it Australia style, but it is no deal in any other terms. Well, let's talk to former Director General of the CBI, a leading businessman and a keen Brexiteer, Lord Digby Jones, who joins us now. Good morning to you, Digby.
Yeah, good morning, Julia. Good morning, everybody.
Do you think it is now almost inevitable that we will see a no deal Brexit?
I don't think it's inevitable. You put your tongue in your cheek when you said deadline on Sunday night. There's a degree of ennui, isn't there, about deadlines from the EU? This is the umpteenth deadline. So the only rationale of this being the final deadline would be that if it is going to be, yes, we're having no deal on the 31st of December, that business needs some time to prepare. So I think there's a greater degree of inevitability to this one than before. He is reported, as you said in your headlines, he's reported as telling his cabinet colleagues that the EU want to punish Britain. He's absolutely right. I mean, I all the way through this, and I've talked to a fair few people in Europe about this, there is a degree of wanting to punish us. There's a degree from some countries of envy. That they, that they can't believe that Britain is standing up to them. They can't believe we're not submitting. I mean, and the sad thing about this is it's all being polarised into now one side is going to win or lose, and words like win and lose and battle and punishment and surrender, and of course today there's a businesswoman in Dusseldorf. She's got a house on the line. She's got 20 people she's employing, and she makes bits for cars that go into Mercedes in Stuttgart and then get on a train, goes through the Channel Tunnel, and they're sold in London. Now, that woman's job, her livelihood, is at risk because of all this. And I think they've just woken up in Europe to the fact that this is a two-way street. Yeah. You know, that where do Germany sell most cars that they make in Germany? Britain. More than America, more than China, it's Britain. Where do they make the biggest margin on their cars? Britain. What will be at risk on the 1st of January? All of that.
And this is the key thing, isn't it? Is that when we talk about, as you say, the win-lose, and again, in real negotiations in business, actually, you go for the win-win. Both sides benefit, and both sides would benefit from a free trade deal. There does seem to be this urge to sort of, to make an example of us. But the key thing here is, if we do have restrictions on trade, if we do have those tariffs, I mean, so be it. I mean, if we can't be agreed, so be it. But it will actually be a tax. That's what a tariff is. It's a tax. That will hurt the consumers on both sides who have to face higher taxes and higher product prices. It will also affect the producers and manufacturers on both sides who may well lose a lot of business, may well end up losing their businesses, losing jobs. No one benefits from this. Everyone benefits from freer trade, which is why people try and strike free trade deals. They've struck free trade deals with Canada, with Japan, it does take the EU a long time to strike a trade deal, normally 7 years. We've managed to do about 20, haven't we, just in the last few months alone under Liz Truss, the International Trade Secretary. But it seems to me that they are very much in a bid to punish us. They are cutting off their noses to spite their face. And I wonder whether the good people, the good consumers and workers of Europe will feel very kindly towards the European Union for doing that.
Oh, you're spot on. And it's becoming a domestic political agenda on both sides of the channel. So Boris cannot go to the now blue wall, used to be red wall in North England, who put his Tory MPs in on the basis of get Brexit done. He cannot go to Parliament, where he's got a lot of his Tory MPs who are saying, come on, this is Brexit, and say, I've given in. And Macron has chosen, it's Macron's own choice. The President of France has chosen to die on the hill of fishing. He's chosen to say, you will give me what I've already got, which is 90% of all the whitefish in your British waters. And by calling his bluff on that, in 3 weeks, well, less than that, isn't it? It's 2.5 weeks' time. He's got 50,000 jobs on Channel ports, which are over. Yeah. Because Britain will just say, get out of our waters. And I'm
quite happy to have the gunboat sent in on that front. If we're gonna play hardball, then let's play hardball. Our waters, international maritime law, no doubt about it. You don't send your trawlers into our water. But that's crazy.
It's madness. And when you saw 2 days ago, the EU published this, if there is no deal, this is how we would suggest things go on for a few months while we sort out no deal. And it was about how do you get trucks through the ports, how do you get people through airports, which is good stuff, absolutely right. But one of the things in this thing was it said, and we'll carry on fishing like we have been now. And they actually put it in the note. And Britain presumably told them where to stick it. Now, at the end of the day, they really do believe that life can go on as it is. But it's a two-way street, this. And I think they're just waking up. If I may say, I think the song team is dropping. I think they've suddenly realised that they've got a problem. And by the way, we'll have a problem. I mean, I'm not being gung-ho and saying it's going to be fine. But it's nowhere near the Armageddon that people say it will.
No, indeed. What do you make of that? Remainers, people who voted Remain, I would say largely actually it's more Ramoners, people who never really accepted the result, who said this is going to be an economic disaster. You own it. You broke it. Your problem to Brexiteers like you and me. I mean, I was saying a little bit earlier on the show, there has not been a single day since I voted for Brexit in June, God, all those heady days ago in June 2016, that the EU has done or said anything at any point that has ever made me question whether that vote was the right decision. They've confirmed for me absolutely why I don't want to be a part of that club. It's a fair point for a lot of Remainers to say, well, hold on a second, you said we'd have a deal. You said it would all be fine. Sunny uplands, where are they? You've got to take responsibility and take the blame for that. What would you say to that?
Well, it's that again is a two-way street, which is wait and see. If you remember, we were going to have death of the firstborn, plague of locusts, in the streets 2 days after the referendum result. So, and that never happened. I have great confidence, for instance, in the City of London, its ability and its innovation to trade with the world in financial services, which is a huge thing for Britain. And we, as you just said in one of your remarks, Julia, we whilst trade deals can take 7 years, if there's a will on both sides, then actually you can get a trade deal in months. And we've proved that with many countries in the last few months.
So it just goes to show there isn't a will.
Oh, there isn't a will. I mean, if there was a will, then the deal would be done. Okay. You cannot say to a country, you are leaving, you're assuming sovereignty, that famous word, you're taking back control. Oh, but by the way, you're not really. Because we don't want you to compete with us. We want to fetter you. We want to punish you. So you're out there. And if you want access to my market, then you're going to be punished. And you can't do that if you've got a real will to have a good quality trade deal. And I repeat, remember, this is about jobs in Germany and France.
As well as here. Finally, briefly, if you would, please, Sir Digby, a report out from the British Retail Consortium today has said that supermarkets and their customers, i.e. all of us, could be hit with a £3 billion annual bill on top of food and drink if there is no post-Brexit trade deal. They say 85% of food imported from the EU is expected to face tariffs of more than 5%, and that would put our food bills up by that amount. What do you say to that?
If there was that tariff, if it applied, there are two ways it can happen in your supermarket. Yes, supermarkets can load the price to pay for it, or supermarkets absorb the price into their profits. And they've done very well in the last few months.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
More tributes just flooding in for Dame Barbara Windsor. I mean, actress, but let's face it, just all round a British legend. She, of course, played Peggy Mitchell in EastEnders and, of course, the legend of the Carry On films as well. She's died very sadly late last night of Alzheimer's. She died peacefully in a London care home. Her husband, Scott Mitchell, announced in the early hours of this morning. Well, let's talk to now one of her really good friends, himself a showbiz legend, Christopher Biggins, who joins us now. Good morning to you, Christopher.
Good morning, Julia.
Good morning. It's incredibly sad news, isn't it? And it, we, even on a day where people are discussing, you know, Brexit and COVID and all of that, there's no doubt at all there are some figures in our country who sort of, you know, just tower above others. And Dame Barbara Windsor would be known by every generation in this country and loved by everyone as well.
Everybody. I mean, she was a total inspiration. And also she was a kind, good friend, and I can say that safely, having known her for, I think I've known her for 50 years. I mean, it's been amazing. I mean, she was always there for me, always there for anybody. You know, she was such a good friend. And Scott, I can't say enough about Scott. I mean, what he's done for Barbara over the last years has just been phenomenal. I mean, he's an extraordinary man. And he's made her last days so special.
And it was a proper love story, that relationship, wasn't it? There were lots of eyebrows raised because he's so much younger than her. But after her diagnosis with Alzheimer's in 2014, they didn't go public with it until just 2 years ago. You know, he's been by her side throughout.
Throughout. Never moved. I mean, he's been just incredible. And he's a wonderful person too. So it is a very sad day that we're losing, you know, I'm losing such a good friend. I mean, you know, we've known she's not been well. But the reality is this morning she's gone. And that is just terrible. I mean, I'm off to do a pantomime on Good Morning, this morning.
Yeah.
With Phil and Holly. And first of all, she was the queen of pantomime. I mean, she was absolutely the epitome of pantomime. She loved it. She loved the public reaction to it. She loved everything about it, and that suddenly, and what she taught me was to be good to her public.
Yeah,
and that was very, very important. She had time for everybody. She actually became annoying sometimes because she would talk to people, and you were dying to get away, and she'd be chatting away and not realising the time, or you had to go somewhere else.
You're thinking, we're trying to have dinner, love. Can we stop talking to the fans?
Exactly,
but this is it. You and I, you know, we know a lot of, well, you know, far more than me, but a lot of people in the showbiz world. There are people who are well known and much loved who actually, frankly, behind the scenes, are not really quite as nice as they pretend on screen. I have never heard anyone even say that Peggy wanted, Barbara Windsor had even given them a dirty look once. She seems to be loved by everyone who ever worked with her and everyone who's ever known her.
She would do a whole restaurant. She'd go into a restaurant and she'd talk to everybody in the restaurant. I mean, she was extraordinary. I went to Venice with her and Scott and my partner 1 year. And we couldn't walk around Venice. I mean, it was extraordinary. And even though she liked people talking to her, she loved talking to the public. So she'd be walking along and she'd go, "Hello, dear, how are you?" And she'd sort of encourage a conversation to happen. Because she loved her public so much. I mean, her public was so important to
her. Indeed, and they loved her back. I mean, depending on your generation, lots of people who really remember her as Peggy Mitchell in EastEnders. I mean, you and I are old enough and lucky enough to remember, obviously, from the Carry On films. I mean, I was just been saying all morning, I can still, in my head, I can hear her giggle and her sort of see her running around topless, you know, trying to cover up her dignity. And that's such an iconic image. But the public took her to their hearts very early on, very quickly. She's not a serious actor. She wasn't seen as someone who was, you know, a great sort of plier of an art or a trade. In a way, people underestimate how good she was because she was able to just, take an audience to heart, and they would take her to heart.
I mean, when you think about her early days at Stratford East, where she played the most wonderful roles, she took to New York and conquered New York in those early days. I mean, it was extraordinary. Her career was extraordinary. I knew her when she was at her lowest, I suppose, where she was going down just before EastEnders and everything. And, of course, EastEnders took her into another level, which was fantastic. And up until then, she was finding it difficult and hard. But she was always up. You know, we did a lot of old-time musicals together. And she was, you know, I remember one of the wonderful stories. She was singing "The Boy I Love Is Up in the Gallery," and I was playing the chairman, and she got some laughs. And she said to me, "Why am I getting laughs?" And I said, "It could be that when you sing that song, the boy on the spot keeps waving at you with a handkerchief." And so she was very polite to the boy and said, "Would you mind stop doing that? I don't want laughs in this song." And, you know, she was so... I said, oh, there were so many stories.
Oh, Chris, it's so lovely to hear you talk about her so beautifully. I mean, very sadly, died at 83, taken far too soon.
Across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and give me a good review. And don't forget to catch me on the Talk Radio Breakfast Show every weekday from 6:30 until 10.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want truly hydrated skin? Meet Osea's Body Care Breakthrough Hyaluronic Body Serum. It's clinically proven to increase hydration by 161%. It's lightweight, fast-absorbing, and delivers 24 hours of hydration for silky smooth skin without any sticky afterfeel. Treat your skin to clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order with code SUMMER at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code SUMMER.